keep it open. We'll carry on into chapter 7. An outsider takes on the ruling elite, says things that they don't like, beats them on their own turf, and is hated for it. That's Stephen. He's our topic once again from the book of Acts. Last week I talked about his ideas. That was a bit unfair, because really Acts 6 didn't tell us his ideas. Acts 7 tells us his ideas, but we sort of preempted it. Because I thought it important to show just where Stephen was coming from. What was underlying the speech he's about to make? What was causing the clashes with these Jewish folk in the synagogue and then on the council? What we're going to do today is we're actually going to listen to his words. They're obviously important. They're important simply because they're in the Bible, but they're particularly important in the book of Acts because it's the longest speech that Luke puts in there. Luke is the writer of Acts, as far as we know, though he doesn't name himself at the beginning. And this is the longest speech we have. So Luke obviously thinks it's important. And it is striking in a number of ways, as I hope we'll see when we work through it. And maybe not the least of which is just the first thing you notice about it. You read your way through this speech, which you could do later. You could read the whole of chapter 7 and read it through. And you remember who he's speaking to. Stephen is speaking to the council, maybe with others viewing as sort of, you know, witnesses and things. And there are many unbelievers present. And yet he makes virtually no reference to the Lord Jesus. Never comments on eternal life. And gives you this huge slice of Jewish history. In fact, let's start there, shall we? Why does Stephen speak this way? If you were suddenly sort of thrown into a room with a large group of unbelieving people and they wanted you to explain to them what you thought, where would you go to? What would you say? Would you do a big talk about Jewish history? So why does he? Firstly, I want you to remember something in reading this. This is only a summary. We don't know everything he said, unless he spoke for a very short time. It's like most speeches within the Bible, we get the summary, the original was probably much longer. Secondly, remember that his speech was, almost certainly, probably, cut short by some angry hearers. So we don't know what he'd have gone on to say. There might have been things he would have said, but he never got there. He was building up towards it, they got angry with him, it all came to a terrible end. Thirdly, I think it's worth remembering that these people that he is speaking to already do know a lot about Jesus. Jesus has lived and worked in their, or at least worked in their city of Jerusalem. He's been up at the temple, and then his apostles have been speaking to them. His apostles have been dragged in front of his council. They've talked about Jesus, who he was, what he did. So it's not as though they're completely ignorant of Jesus. But fourthly, I think that what we see in Stephen's approach is great wisdom. Stephen sees that he must deal with their biggest need, these hearers, and that's their bias. These people listening to him think they know God, and they know how God works, and they know how life works. And so what Stephen does is he takes hold of their story, their history, and uses it to strike their confidence about how they know God. To strike their foolish confidence. Now that is wise. That's worth remembering for yourself. Very useful for us to remember for ourselves and when we talk to others about the Lord Jesus. It matters that there are points in our lives when we receive or we give out words that strike a nerve, that press on a person's life or which press on our life. We want words that strike home. You know, in conversation with a friend or with a family member or with a stranger, we want words which challenge them, challenge them to change, because for all of us there's a call to repent, a call to turn our minds, a call to truly know God through Jesus Christ. But the thing is, when we say, well, we want challenging words are different for different people. They're not just all the same thing. There's not one magic challenging sentence where if you throw it at anybody, it will affect them. Stephen uses Jewish history because he knows this will press in upon the people listening to him. He's about to use their story against them. Yeah, you could, let's say you deal with one person and you're in a conversation with them. I know you're riding on a train with them or something. You think, well, I want to say something that might make them think about God. So you say to them, do you ever think about eternity? Do you ever think about what lies beyond death? And they react. They're shocked that you would ask them such a question and they want to talk about it. There could be somebody else though, same train, same table, same conversation from your side, and they just think, gobbledygook, I'm the foggiest idea what you're talking about, and they just close the conversation down. They just kill it. It means nothing to them. The word eternity has no meaning to them whatsoever. They don't think there's anything beyond death. You saying the word eternity just seems freaky religious talk, and they have no idea what you're going on about. But on the other hand, had you got into a conversation with them about, let's say, their lifestyle, maybe, say, their most recent relationship and what happened in it and why it went so sour, you might then start to actually press on something that's sensitive in their life. You might actually find that a conversation does open up. Because that does reach to them. It does speak to them. You might get in conversation with a third person, completely different, and that person might already have some awareness of Jesus. You might actually find that you don't need to press anything in on them. The conversation kicks off because they've already heard. They've had a background. They've had a Christian friend in the past. And meeting you as a Christian just suddenly opens them back up and they want to talk about more about this. The point is just this. That generally, evangelism is personal. In other words, we listen to others first. We try to understand where they're coming from, who they are, and then we aim to speak of our Lord in a way that actually does touch their life. There's no just magic sentence that will get them going. It will depend on who they are. So when Stephen stands up before that council, he doesn't just say to them, don't you know there's a hell? Why doesn't he say that? Because they could probably just brush that off. It wouldn't mean much to them. They could just say, well, yeah, it's nothing to do with us. That's where Gentiles go. But he does this, and this winds them up. This presses on them. It touches on their lives. When you want to speak to somebody about the Lord, listen first. Try to understand them. And try to think and pray as you do. What would be a way for me to speak that actually does reach into their life and speaks to them of God? The other thing just to say before we carry on then, looking at Stephen himself, is just, by the way, remember the Lord will do the same to you as a Christian. There are points where he will put somebody into your life, even as a Christian, who will touch on a raw nerve with you. They will say something. A pastor teaching at the front, a Christian who sat next to you after church, a Christian friend who gets in touch with you, and they'll say something and the Lord will have used them to touch on a raw nerve in your life, to expose something you're going wrong in, shouldn't be doing, should address, should think about. Expect this to be done to you. And when it does, don't just get angry. Actually listen. Very easy to get angry. When people touch that sensitive place in our life that we want to stay hidden and we don't want anybody else nosying in there because we want to keep it the way it is, even though we're aware it's sort of wrong. Don't get all angry and self-defensive. Listen. Be changed by it. So the point anyway, as we come into the speech, why speak this way? Why not sort of speak differently? Because Stephen knows his hearers and he knows what will challenge them. Other thing to say about Stephen, though, is that he's not only evangelising, he's not just there to speak to unbelievers. Stephen is a great theologian. He's a teacher of Christians. Stephen, as you read his words, as you hear what he's saying, you see that he is thinking through all the implications of having come to know Jesus Christ, and he's seeing implications that maybe some of the other Christian leaders aren't yet seeing and aren't yet talking about. Stephen is taking the church forward. He is preparing the church for its great expansion in its life that Luke's about to tell us about from chapter 8 onwards. The reason Luke puts this speech, of all speeches in, at its longest, is because this speech shows a Christian leader who understood what was changing in the church and what was needed to be seen now. The church was about to go worldwide. It was about to expand out amongst half-Jews and amongst Gentiles. Stephen's speech is the starting point that really gets people thinking about it. Stephen is a pastor. He's teaching Christians as well. I'd imagine he's already pastored some of the thousands of Jewish Christians now in Jerusalem. We've read how many have become Christians. Well, the apostles are not all personally pastoring those thousands. It just wouldn't happen. They've got their own local pastors, maybe in the synagogues where they met. Those Jewish Christians, Stephen was probably a pastor amongst those from the Grecian background. In the synagogue, he would have taught them, and in other ways, he'd have gone round to their homes and taught them. That's why his name was put forward by the church when the apostles said, "We're going to need 7 good men." People already knew folk like Stephen. They could say, "Well, we've got this guy, he really cares for us, and he's really taught us. You know, we recommend him to come forward to be with you in the work." So Stephen was already a pastor, I should think, though it doesn't say it explicitly, but I imagine he was already a pastor. He was certainly already thinking about what does it mean for Christ to be who he is and what he's done. And now he's got this wider platform to talk about it. So he's an evangelist, he's challenging unbelievers, but he's also a theologian and a pastor who's teaching Christians. What does Stephen teach? I said last time, one of the ways to think about his words is to think about holy ground. Now, I'm not going to go over all I said then, but maybe just ask yourself this question this morning. Where do you find God on earth? Where do you find God on the earth? Where do you have to go? Now, the Jews would have said, well, you've got to go to Israel. We've been marked out. Hey, I mean, you know, we've been marked out by God. We've got laws that no one else has got. God's laws. We've got signs. Physical signs that no one else has got. We've got circumcision. Other people don't do that. The Greeks don't do that. They don't slice bits off of men's private parts. We do, said the Jews. Marks us out as different. We've got one true temple. We don't have these multiple temples scattered around the world like Roman gods. We've got one great temple on the hill, Mount Zion, here in Jerusalem. And this has been our story for 2,000 years. This land, this hill, this God, these markers, these laws. Look up at that temple, they would say. Look how beautiful it is. This is holy ground. It's where you find God. Now, what Stephen does is he just raises topics from their history which ask if their answer is really so simple. Are you sure about this? He says. You're sure this is where God is found? Their response, of course, is to get livid. But they can't beat his argument, so they twist his words to get him condemned. This fellow never stops speaking against this holy place and against the law. Well, he might be raising questions about it, but they're now starting to slander him. We've heard him say this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs Moses handed down to us. Well, there's truth in that. But they're twisting it to get him into trouble. So into chapter 7 then, let's listen to Stephen. The high priest asked him, "Are these charges true?" And so Stephen begins. Now where does his story begin? To this he replied, "Brothers and fathers, listen to me." He doesn't treat these people with contempt, does he? These are his people. They are his brothers and fathers. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham while he was still in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran. Jewish story begins with Abraham. Now everyone agrees there on that. Everybody present agrees. He's the great forefather. But where did he live, says Stephen? Where was he when God met him? Mesopotamia. Iraq. Oh, not Israel. No, not Israel. God met him in the land where the Jews would later be exiled. He met him down in the land of the Chaldeans, in Babylon. Now that immediately raises the question then, doesn't it? So God doesn't necessarily need the temple and the mountain and the... Oh yeah, but of course God brought him out of there, they could say. Verse 3. Leave your country and your people, God said, and go to the land I will show you. So there we go then. So, okay, he found him in Iraq, but then he brought him out. Brought him up to Israel. Yes? Well, yes and no. So he left the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. Well, that's not Israel. That's somewhere to the north. And he lived there till his father died. So Abraham, the great forefather of the Jews, didn't seem in a desperate rush to get to the Holy Land. If that was the place you met God, why wasn't he concerned to get there within a month, within a week? It took years for him to arrive. And when he finally did get there, verse 5, God gave him no inheritance here, not even a foot of ground. Well, God promised him that he and his descendants after him would possess the land. Well, even at that time, Abraham had no child. So Abraham, the great Jewish forefather, he really knew God, didn't he? When he lived in Iraq and when he lived in maybe Syria. But then he finally got the promised land, but then of course he didn't own anything here, so it wasn't really his country at that point. Oh, but God did vow, didn't he would get the land. It was only a matter of time. I mean, it was all going to happen very soon, wasn't it? I mean, you know, just once he got a son, it'd all be sorted out. Or maybe it wouldn't. God spoke to him, verse 6, in this way. Your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and ill-treated for 400 years. Stephen is saying to them, you do remember how your story works, don't you? You know, you've got this little picture in your minds about how the story works. You do remember how it actually works. God calls Abraham to a special land, the Holy Land, where he doesn't give him any of it. And then actually, he kicks him back out again and says that he and his family have got to go and live somewhere else for 400 years. In fact, they can't just go and live somewhere else for 400 years. They've got to go and live somewhere else for 400 years whilst being slaves. The people who think that the land they walk on and the mountain they look up to and the temple they go into is all so significant if you want to know God, this first part of the story doesn't really seem to work for them. Abraham knew God while spending most of his time in other places. Of course, it was okay. I mean, God made another promise, but I will punish the nation, verse 7. They serve as slaves, God said, and afterwards they will come out of that country and worship me in this place. So it's okay. God makes another promise. He'll bring the family back and at last they'll know God and worship God in the land. So it will have taken 400 plus years, but it will all be all right in the end. But do you start to feel the point that Stephen's making to these Jewish folk? For them, location, 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 it's so significant, it's so precious to them. Stephen's saying, I don't think you're really seeing things the way God sees things. This land that you think is so significant, it took 400 years for God to actually reinsert the Jews into it. Seems that God doesn't see his work as going forward in the way you do. You see it as all land-based. God seems to see it as based on something else. I wonder what that could be. Now, Stephen hasn't said. He's telling the story to make them ask the questions in their own heads, in their own hearts. You see, what sits beneath Paul Stephen's words is this question. What was God doing with Abraham? Why is it such a weird story? You know, I'm going to take this man, I'm going to give him his own land, his own family, I'm going to establish them, and then he doesn't. What was he doing? Was it about the land after all? No, it wasn't. It was actually exactly what the New Testament says elsewhere. It was all about faith. You see, the key to Abraham's story, which if Stephen's Jewish hearers would just think about it, they would unlock the way Christians like Stephen are doing, was never about the land. That was a secondary matter. It was all about him living by trust in God. In Hebrews, when the writer of the Hebrews summarises Abraham, he says in Hebrews 11, by faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, but like a stranger in a foreign country, he lived in tents. Well, as did Isaac, well, and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. The writer of the Hebrews says, Abraham had to spend his whole time looking forward. He never got what was promised. So what was God doing with him? He was seeking faith from him. When you read of Abraham, when you read of his story, Stephen says, you're not supposed to end up saying, that's right, find the right location and God will meet with you. We've got it on the hill, God's with us. When you read the story of Abraham, you realise that God meets people by faith. He brings them into situations where they trust in him. It's not about where they are, it's about their response to him. If you want to know God, if you want to meet God, you meet him by faith, no matter what your location is. And then, when you have trusted him, then maybe he'll take you on to a home he's planned for you. But it doesn't begin with the location, it begins with the faith. Get it the right way round. And that's what Stephen's trying to get his hearers to see. They've got it all the wrong way round. The right way round is you have faith in God first, then he gives you a home. Not find the right land, and then maybe you'll get faith in God. Faith comes first. Now, think about implications of that just towards the end of the sermon. But firstly, let's just do a little bit more of the verses here. Because Stephen drives it further home with verse 8. Then he gave Abraham the covenant of circumcision. And Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him 8 days after his birth. And later Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob became the father of the 12 patriarchs. Speaking to a bunch of Jewish folk, you've got to mention circumcision, so Stephen does. It's the great sign in their mind. The great sign that they love, the marker that shows that God is on their side. It's not just the temple at the end of the day on the hill. It's circumcision. It's the mark of the Jews. Or if you want to put it differently, an embarrassing scar that you tend not to show others. Stephen points out here that circumcision is a covenant. In other words, it's an agreement. It's something that God put into place to bind Abraham with. He came to an agreement with him using circumcision. Now, what was that agreement about? What was God doing? Well, you go back, you read Genesis 12 through to 17, read the story of Abraham in the book of Genesis, and you'll find when God gives circumcision. When does he give it to Abraham? Chapter 12, when he first finds him in Iraq? No. Chapter 14, when he's meeting somebody like Melchizedek? No. He gives him circumcision long after the promises he first made. It only comes when Abraham starts to go wrong. You remember how Abraham went wrong? Anybody want to remind us? Take a pause from me speaking for a moment. How did Abraham go wrong? Hagar. And she was a servant. And Abraham, at Sarah's encouragement, takes Hagar as his slave wife, sires a child with her, a son, Ishmael. They decided to stop waiting for God. Here they were in a land, but they didn't own any of it. They were going to have a child, but they never had the child. They were getting old, everything was going bad. They weren't going to have any children now. Only answer, fix it. Let's take a slave wife, have a child, fix it. But God's promise still stood. He was still going to give a child. He was still going to give Isaac. And so God had to come and tell Abraham off, and he gave him this binding agreement of circumcision. And effectively it was God saying to Abraham, no more of that. No more of trying to fix it yourself. Now circumcision is brutal. It's self-mutilation. And God says when he gives it to Abraham, self-mutilate or lose everything. Take your choice. There you go. It's God saying to Abraham, look, you want to make my plans come true using your methods, yeah? You want to make my plans work by you using your human flesh to fix it. You think that everything I promise in the end is all going to have to depend upon your private parts and how you use them. Well, I'll tell you what then. I'll give you a covenant based on that, shall I? Circumcision is a very painful lesson in the folly of trying to live in your own strength, of trying to live by the power of human flesh, what I can achieve instead of by faith. So circumcision was an agreement to control Abraham and his family, to keep them from the stupidity they were falling into. But you know, the sin runs deep, doesn't it? I mean, as Stephen says, well, of course, then Abraham had Isaac, and he circumcised him, and Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons, and I'm sure all they all got circumcised. But what were they like? Verse 9. Because the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph, they sold him as a slave into Egypt. Do you see what Stephen's doing? He's not just reminding them of circumcision and reminding them of this thing they value so highly. He's then saying, oh yeah, circumcision. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, 12 lads. Great godly family, eh? Oh, apart from that moment when 10 of the brothers actually beat up, nearly killed, and then sold their own brother into slavery. That didn't go too well, did it? That bit of the story. If they read between the lines of Stephen's speech or hear what he's saying, there's quite an accusation in there. Maybe circumcised men don't always do the right thing. Like they put their Messiah to death. Now he hasn't said that in so many words. But he's undermining all their confidence. They're so sure, we got the temple, we got the law, we got circumcision, we got the high priest. And Stephen's saying, why don't you think again about what you've got? 10 of the patriarchs sold their brother into slavery. And where was God then? But God was with Joseph and rescued him from all his troubles. He gave Joseph wisdom and enabled him to gain the goodwill of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so made him ruler over Egypt and all his palace. Where was God found in the days of the 12 great patriarchs? In Israel? With the circumcised 11? No. In Egypt with the enslaved one. Was he in the Holy Land blessing everywhere? No, he was down in Egypt blessing everywhere. Then a famine struck all Egypt and Canaan, bringing great suffering, and our fathers could not find food. When Jacob heard there was grain in Egypt, he sent our fathers on their first visit. You wonder how much strength he's putting on our fathers, our wonderful fathers. Don't you just love, you know, great-great-granddad and the way he used to, like, kill his brothers? That was a lark, wasn't it? The blessings weren't in the Holy Land. They were to bail out of the Holy Land and go off to Egypt. Even when they arrived, Joseph still didn't trust them. On their second visit, Joseph told his brothers who he was, and Pharaoh learned about Joseph's family. And then finally, the whole family just end up in Egypt. After this, Joseph sent for his father Jacob and his whole family, 75 in all. Then Jacob went down to Egypt, where he and our fathers died. So much for the Holy Land. All the great starting family of Judaism, all the great names of the tribes, Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah and Asher and Dan and Naphtali and all the others, all down in Egypt, all buried in Egypt, because it was just death back in the Holy Land. And when they finally did get buried back in Israel, their bodies were brought back to Shechem and placed in the tomb that Abraham had bought from the sons of Hamor at Shechem for a certain sum of money. At the end of his days, Abraham could sit in his, whatever it was, his old man's bed, and he could look across the room at Sarah in her old woman's bed, and he could say, "Well, we made it. I own a graveyard. Shall we go and see it, dear?" That's all he had. He had a cemetery at the end. Nothing else. What Stephen's doing, Stephen's lesson is a vital lesson. What he's doing is, he's talking to these Jewish folk. He's not saying, "I don't care about Israel." He's not saying, "I don't care about the temple." They accuse him of that. He doesn't say that. But what he is saying is, get it the right way round. God's story was never about get the location right, get the physical symbols right, get the laws right, everything else comes right. The story was always, firstly, start with faith, start with trust, believe in God first. Abraham was called to believe in a promise that he barely saw come to life. And that's what he had to hold on to. That's what Hebrews 11 praises Abraham for. Stephen's hearers think, "We've got the city, we've got the land, we've got the temple, we've got the laws, we've got God." No, they're good gifts from God. But if you have them without faith, you've got nothing, says Stephen. And anyway, God doesn't need them, does he? Because the fact is, he blessed and kept his people in other lands, in other ways, without any of this. Stephen is just questioning their whole basis of thinking, questioning their desperate need of the temple, and just pointing out all the limitations of Jewish markers and Jewish laws that they rely on. Now, okay, just to wrap up, what does this do for us? What is this Jewish speech? What lessons could it have for Christians who live in a very different place and time? Lesson number one. Your current circumstances do not automatically prove that you are close to God. Abraham trusted God, knew God, whilst he was far away, down in Mesopotamia. Meanwhile, when he was in the Holy Land, the Promised Land, he failed God. Joseph knew God when he was down in Egypt, far away, dressed like an Egyptian, with a shaved head like an Egyptian, behaving like an Egyptian. Canaan had just been the place where he got mugged. It's important for us to be aware that our current circumstances do not automatically prove that we are close to God. If you assess how well you're doing in loving God by how easy your life is, really doesn't work that way. God will put you into circumstances where you can trust him, because that's what he wants from you. It may be that the hardest circumstances you currently have in your life, the most difficult place that you'd rather not have, and you might be pleading with God to remove it, and that's not a bad prayer to pray. I don't think Joseph was happy to get mugged, beaten up and sold. But it might be that the hardest place in your life is the best of places at this moment, because it's the place where you could be trusting God and showing faith in him. On the other hand, you might have a thoroughly easy and lovely life right now and be barely showing any faith in God whatsoever. Current circumstances don't automatically prove you're close to God. Second thing I think is worth saying as well, you know, just thinking about these guys that Stephen's talking to, is that blessings just don't necessarily make you a better Christian. You know, once Abraham was finally in the land, was it all okay? No, that's where it went pear-shaped. Once he was in the land, then he started trying to fix his own family without God. We can imagine that if we had certain blessings, that would then help us to be the Christians we want to be. Once I've got the child I want, once I've got the income I need, once I've made the next move to the right house, then my Christian life will become sweet. Then at last, once I've got that gift in my life, once I've got that blessing, that will fix my faith. Then my faith will function properly. Look, it doesn't work that way, does it? God calls you to faith now, where you are. If you're waiting for something to get fixed, because that will help you to be more trusting of God, it doesn't work that way. You trust God now, where you are. Do you really think that if you don't trust him today, that you're going to trust him any better tomorrow because your bank statement's gone up by 500 quid? That just meant you were trusting the money. Trust him now. By all means, pray that you'll be released from the hard circumstances. Pray for the blessings to come. They're not bad things. Fact is that God installed Joseph in Egypt. He made him the second wealthiest man in the country, and then he provided care for a whole country and then for his own family. But don't think that once you've got the blessing, then you'll show faith. It doesn't work that way round. You need to show faith today. You need to trust him now. And the third thing to say is that includes when he does press on that raw nerve we talked about earlier. It really was a raw nerve, wasn't it? I guess in more than one sense, when God gave the covenant of circumcision, God actually created the raw nerves at that point, and very painful they were too. There are times when God will find something in your life, he'll send that person to speak to you, they'll press upon something that needs to change in your life. You've got to think about how you're going to react. You could get angry. How dare anyone question me about this? How dare they question how I raise my family, do my job, treat my wife? Now look, other people, and that includes other Christians, say some really dumb and hurtful things. And we're not talking about those. People say dumb and hurtful things, and we do it to others. And often we don't even notice we've done it, which makes us very grateful for the patience that people show to us. But there are times when something is said to us where it's not dumb and hurtful, it's just pressing on something that ought to change, but we're unwilling to change it and we've been trying to hide it. It's been a sinful way of life, it's been a foolish practice, it's something. And the Lord opens it up to you. The Lord puts his finger on it. Just like he did with Abraham and said, "You can't do this Ishmael thing again." When the Lord speaks to you through a friend, through a teacher like Stephen, a pastor, whoever, and maybe it upsets you initially when you first hear it, but it's needed, then at that point, listen. Face it. And then pray that you will change. So God help us. God help us to live by faith. And only by faith, not trusting our own strength, but believing all things of him. Amen.